welcome to this special edition of the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Fowler. As part of the OncView video series, Cancer Network spoke with Dr. Zofia Piotrowska, an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and a lung cancer medical oncologist at Massachusetts General Hospital, about some recent data and review updates in the treatment landscape for patients with non-small cell lung cancer and exon 20 insertions. Could we start with just a brief overview of EGFR mutations leading up to the identification of EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations as a therapeutic target?
Sure. This is a very important question because I would say the landscape of EGFR mutations in non-small cell lung cancer has gotten increasingly complex in recent years. EGFR mutations were first discovered back in 2004, but historically we've thought about these most as the most common sensitizing mutations, which are EGFR exon 19 deletions and L858R point mutations. Those mutations are very sensitive to many EGFR inhibitors and commonly are treated with drugs like osimertinib first line. But recently we've identified that EGFR exon 20 insertions, which make up about 5 to 10% of EGFR mutations in lung cancer, are their own unique entity. These have historically been resistant to older generations of EGFR inhibitors, and they've become relevant in recent years because we've now had new and more effective therapies for patients with these mutations. So I think now it's really important not just to recognize that your patient may have an EGFR mutation on their molecular testing report, but specifically look at which type of mutation they have and think about how the implications of that specific mutations for treatment.
Right, and I think you alluded to this briefly, but what is the clinical significance of EGFR exon 20 insertion as a target?
So I think when you find an EGFR exon 20 insertions, the significance is that there is now several approved therapies for patients with these mutations, and so therefore it has an impact on treatment. And I know we're going to talk about some of those recent approvals during this program.
Right, and before we get there, how have the NCCN guidelines been updated to recognize EGFR exon 20 as a distinct driver mutation?
So the guidelines have been updated to recognize these as a unique driver. So I think the take home here is that an EGFR exon 20 insertion is a unique driver in lung cancer, and it can't be considered in the same exact category as EGFR exon 19 deletions and L858R mutations.
So let's look at testing. And is exon 20 insertion something that a typical NGS panel looks for? And really, if not, how should clinicians test for this gene alteration?
These are mutations that are picked up with typical DNA-based next-generation sequencing assays. So most of the multi-gene panels that we're using these days will detect these. And again, I think the important thing is to be able to notice that an EGFR mutation has been discovered and that this specific EGFR mutation may not be the same as the more common exon 19 deletions and L858R point mutations. So it's important to read the report carefully and distinguish these different mutations.
So which patients should be tested for this alteration and when should they be tested? And I guess really to expand on that, you know, what are the factors that you look for in patients to ultimately lead to testing?
I think now in 2021, broad molecular testing using a multi-gene next-generation sequencing panel should be the standard of care for all newly diagnosed patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer, particularly those with non-squamous histologies. And those panels should include EGFR exon 20 insertions. I think we used to think of looking for EGFR mutations as something that was most important in patients who are never smokers or have a light smoking history. And that is indeed one of the factors that can predict for these mutations. But, you know, we've seen these mutations happen in even patients with more significant smoking histories. So I think it really is important to do testing for all of our patients. And ideally, that testing should be done at the time of initial diagnosis so that we can help select even the best first-line therapy for these patients.
And could you talk about some of the current barriers that exist to testing and the knowledge gaps in molecular profiling right now?
I think there's a few different challenges. We know that molecular testing, even today in 2021, is still not done as commonly as it should be. There are some barriers to getting the testing itself. So sometimes, especially when we're looking at tissue-based testing, the tissue is exhausted and used up by the initial by the pathologist to establish the diagnosis. And by the time we get to molecular testing, it may be fairly scant or insufficient for testing. In those cases, I would say that liquid biopsies your circulating tumor DNA can be a helpful adjunct and can be useful to do molecular testing, although I always caution that when we're using liquid biopsies or circulating tumor DNA, you have to remember that if the results don't come back with an oncogene driver, it could be not because that there is no oncogene driver, but because that tumor hasn't shed enough DNA into the circulation to be detected. So I think, you know, working closely with pathologists to make sure that the tissue is used carefully and as much as possible is safe for molecular testing. And then also thinking about the use of liquid biopsies are important steps that we can take to improve the rates of testing. And then I think the other big category is waiting for test results and being able to appropriately interpret NGS reports to identify which mutations are present and help patient and ensure that we're selecting the right treatments for patients. And I've seen in my own practice that has gotten more and more complicated in recent years as we have new and increasing targeted therapies available for patients. So I think that is another challenge is, you know, when we do get that report, what do the results mean? Where can we go to help distinguish, is this an EGFR exon 20 insertion, exon 19 deletion? How do we interpret those reports to make the best decisions for our patients? And that's something as a community, I think we really have to work on going forward.
Let's start to look at those treatment options that you mentioned. Let's start with historically, what has the treatment approach been like for patients with EGFR exon 20 insertions?
So we've known for a long time that the commonly used first and second generation EGFR inhibitors, erlotinib, gefitinib, and afatinib, were ineffective therapies for these patients. I think the jury is still out on third generation EGFR inhibitors like osimertinib, but they seem the data that we have so far certainly seems to show that these drugs are not as effective as they are for exon 19 deletions and L858R point mutations. And so for a long time, exon 20 insertion mutation positive lung cancers were treated with standard chemotherapy, and that still remains a very good option for these patients. We think about first line therapy with carboplatin and pemetrexed chemotherapy for these patients. There's debate in the field about whether they should be treated with chemo and immunotherapy combinations or whether immunotherapy may be less beneficial for patients with EGFR exon 20 as it may be for other types of EGFR mutations. So I would say the jury's still out on the role of immunotherapy, but certainly chemotherapy remains an important treatment option as it has been historically for these patients.
Let's look specifically at amivantamab. Could you first describe the mechanism of action of this drug and then also kind of get into the patient population trial design and important data that led to its approval in May of 2021?
Yes, we were very excited to see amivantamab receive accelerated approval by the FDA. It was really the first therapy specifically approved for patients with EGFR exon 20 insertion positive non-small cell lung cancer. It was approved for patients who have progressed on prior platinum-based chemotherapy. So when we think about how to treat these options, it's important to remember that this is the second line or later option. Amivantamab is a bispecific antibody targeting EGFR and MET, and it was approved based on the results of the Chrysalis trial, which was recently published by Dr. Park and colleagues in JCO in 2021. In the Chrysalis trial, approximately 81 patients with EGFR exon 20 insertion mutant non-small cell lung cancer who had received prior platinum-based chemotherapy were treated with amivantamab. And we saw in that population that the response rate to amivantamab was 40%. The median duration of response was 11 months, and the median progression-free survival was 8.3 months. So certainly encouraging data in this population where limited targeted therapy options had previously been limited. We did see, of course, with amivantamab that there were some toxicities, as you might expect with an antibody targeting EGFR and MET. The most common toxicities that were seen included rash. About 86% of patients had rashes, although many of these were low grade. And then important to know when using amivantamab, about two-thirds of patients had infusion-related reactions. And these seem to be most common on cycle one, day one, with the initial treatment. And there are guidelines in the package insert to mitigate these infusion reactions, including pre-medication, split dosing over cycle one, day one, and day two. But it is something important to be aware of and counsel patients about when treating with amivantamab.
Great. And so really, what's the significance or what is the impact of this approval for patients with EGFR exon 20 insertions?
Well, it's great to have another option for patients with these mutations. And I think this is a very good option for patients. Again, it's approved for second line and later use. So it doesn't necessarily impact our first line treatment for patients with EGFR exon 20 insertions as of today. But it, I think it is a very good option to consider for patients who have received platinum-based chemotherapy and are looking for a second or later line option.
So can we shift gears now to mobocertinib? And can you kind of talk again about the EXCLAIM trial that led to its approval for patients?
Yes. Mobocertinib was the second drug approved for EGFR exon 20 insertions. Again, really great to have two different targeted therapy options for these patients. Mobocertinib has a different mechanism of action than amivantamab. Mobocertinib is an oral EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor, so an oral targeted therapy. And it was approved based on the results of the EXCLAIM trial, which was the initial study of mobocertinib and included a phase one and phase two portion. Mobocertinib received accelerated approval by FDA based on the results of the EXCLAIM trial, which included 114 patients with EGFR exon 20 insertion positive non-small cell lung cancer, all of whom had progressed on prior platinum-based chemotherapy and who were treated with osimertinib in the second or later line setting. In this population, we saw a response rate of 28% by blinded independent review. Here we saw a median duration of response of 17.5 months and a median progression-free survival of 7.3 months. Again, showing really promising results with an oral targeted therapy for these patients. Toxicities are important to be aware of, as with all new therapies. And with mobocertinib, we have seen that EGFR-related toxicities, which we've seen with older generations of EGFR inhibitors, have been seen. Most notably, 91% of patients who were treated with mobocertinib at the recommended phase 2 dose of 160 milligrams did have diarrhea, including 21% of patients having grade 3 or higher diarrhea. So this is an important side effect to be aware of, to monitor closely for, and to counsel patients about. We also saw about 45% of patients having a rash, although the majority of patients had low-grade rash. But overall, again, I think an active therapy for these patients. The accelerated approval by the FDA is for patients who have received prior platinum-based chemotherapy. So again, an option in the second or later line setting for patients with EGFR exon 20 insertion positive lung cancers who've progressed on prior chemo.
So let's now transition to treatment selection in patients. And what is the first line treatment option for patients with EGFR exon 20 insertion positive non-small cell lung cancer?
So although we now have two approved targeted therapies for these patients, unfortunately, neither of them is approved in the frontline setting. There are some ongoing clinical trials looking at first-line treatment options for these patients, but as of today in 2021, the preferred first-line treatment for these patients is still platinum-based chemotherapy, carboplatin pemetrexed. And again, the role of immunotherapy for these patients, I think, is still an open question, whether we should be giving them first-line chemo and immunotherapy combinations, or whether perhaps patients with EGFR exon 20 insertions may have less benefit from immunotherapy. We've seen that in the case of more common sensitizing mutations where immunotherapy alone is certainly less active than in other types of lung cancer. So I think it's still an open question whether these patients should receive chemo alone or chemo immunotherapy. And it's something that needs to be decided on a patient level and in discussion with patients. But I think both mobocertinib and amivantamab are approved and options for second or later line therapy. So when your patients progress on that platinum-based chemotherapy regimen, that's when we start thinking about these new approvals.
And with these two agents that we've been discussing that have received recent approvals, what are some of the treatment options for patients who might progress on these?
So I think before we talk about what treatment options might be available for patients who've progressed on amivantamab and mobocertinib. Many people have asked me, how should we be selecting between these options? How do we think about mobocertinib and amivantamab? Again, both approved for second or later line therapy. I think here it really will be a discussion with patients as to some of the safety profile differences in these drugs, some of the logistics and how they're administered and picking what's best for patients. Amivantamab is a IV therapy. It's administered initially weekly for the first 4 weeks of treatment and then every 2 weeks thereafter. So it requires patients to come to clinic on a regular basis, whereas mobocertinib is an oral therapy. And so, you know, often patients will prefer an oral therapy, although again, with mobocertinib, you know, we see that patients can have frequent and sometimes high grade diarrhea. And so both of these, I think, are important considerations. And so we really have to talk to patients and decide which of these factors make one of these drugs the preferred second line option for each individual patient. You know, we're now seeing new drugs in development even beyond mobocertinib and amivantamab. We've seen recent data presented at ASCO last year from a drug from Dizal Therapeutics, DZD9008, another drug from Cullinan Oncology, CLN081, and a number of others in development. So I think that in the future, you know, both of these agents are effective, but there is still lots of room for improvement in terms of both efficacy, safety. CNS penetration will be an important issue going forward. You know, many of these patients have brain metastases, and I think we're still learning about the CNS activity of these compounds, but we are worried that maybe they're not as CNS active as we'd like. So I think going forward, we will need new and better treatments, but certainly exciting to have these options available to us today.
Perfect. And to sum up this section, is there a role for sequencing mobocertinib and amivantamab?
I think that's a very important question. And the short answer is we don't know yet. I think there is probably a role for sequencing these two agents because, you know, when we think about patients with stage 4 lung cancer, we really want to think about using all of the options at our disposal to help keep their cancer in check. But I think we don't know what the optimal sequence is, whether perhaps amivantamab would be effective after mobocertinib or the converse, whether mobocertinib would be effective after amivantamab. I think that's something we're going to have to learn going forward. And I think that will be a very important question in terms of how we decide, you know, how to sequence these agents in the future.
So let's transition to our last section and look ahead towards the future. You know, what are some remaining unmet needs in this patient population?
It's great to see the progress that we've made, but I would say there's still many, many unmet needs in this patient population. I think to start with, we can say that the efficacy results that we're seeing are great, but they're still far from the high rates of responses that we're used to seeing, for example, with osimertinib in the more common types of EGFR mutations like exon 19 deletion or L858R. And so I think even more effective therapies would be great. We've also seen, you know, some toxicities with these agents, including GI and skin toxicities with mobocertinib, infusion reactions and skin toxicities with amivantamab. And so I think treatment options in the future that may minimize those toxicities and be even better tolerated would certainly be welcome. I also think that, you know, acquired resistance to these agents is still an unknown. What treatment options may be available for patients who've progressed on these options will be really important to evaluate. And then finally, I'll make the point of CNS metastases. Many of these patients have brain metastases, and I think we need better and more CNS penetrant options in the future as well.
Right. And you previously had briefly mentioned some ongoing trials in this space. You know, could you talk a little bit about some of the ones that really intrigue you that could have a strong impact on the field?
I think there's a number of new drugs in development that are trying to develop agents with a better therapeutic window. So we know that many of the toxicities that we see with these agents have to do with the fact that while these drugs may inhibit the mutant EGFR and the exon 20 insertion mutant EGFR, they also have activity against wild type EGFR, which all of us have in our skin and in our gut and lead to some of these toxicities. So there's a number of drugs now in development that are trying to be more specific for that mutant EGFR, again, including DZD9008, CLN081, a drug from Black Diamond Therapeutics, and a number of others that are in development and I think have the potential to be potentially more effective and have a better safety profile. I think we're also seeing trials of combinations of these agents or combinations of one of these agents, for example, with chemotherapy or others. And there again, we hope that may lead to improved efficacy.
Perfect. And to wrap things up, do you have any closing thoughts that you have to share that we haven't really touched on in this area?
I think it's just really an exciting time for targeted therapies in lung cancer broadly and specifically within the field of EGFR. I think it's important to close on the fact that I recognize that it's a challenge for oncologists, particularly general oncologists, to recognize these increasingly complicated next generation sequencing reports, to identify these mutations and to select between the many treatment options that we have. And so I would just encourage you to carefully read these NGS reports. And if you're not sure what a particular mutation means, reach out to either those that issued the report or to larger academic centers so that we can help you ensure that you're selecting the best treatment for your patients, explore clinical trial options that may be available, and just help make sure that we're getting the best treatments to each patient.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast is the official podcast of Cancer Network, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter @CancerNetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn @CancerNetwork.